One of the things was that we became much better at putting longing at the heart of our activism. So the poet Rilke once said, "The future must enter into you a long time before it happens."
Welcome to today's episode where I chat with Rob Hopkins. Rob is the author of the book From What Is to What If, one of my favorite books of all time, and it's very much about the importance of imagination and story to create the future that we're all longing for. Rob cites many different examples of the people, the cooperatives, the communities that are doing projects that are helping us step into this more beautiful future that our hearts are all longing for. This conversation was probably the most fun conversation I've ever had, and true to his book on imagination, we really got to play our heartfelt imagination, so I hope you enjoy it even as half as much as I do. Hi Rob, thanks for joining today, and I will start a conversation with setting the context, and we kind of just did this offline, and it was what I thought was perfect. So now I feel the pressure to set the same context. I would just say how I think we're really bereft of stories in our culture. And I think myth has formed an important part of our culture. And your book and your work gives a lot of hope. And I think we've been bamboozled to believe the kind of dominant capitalist story is our own, and it's very much not our human story. It's the last 20 seconds of our human story. Our human story is very much about altruism, about being in harmony with nature, about ingenuity, about, yeah, togetherness. So I thought I would start with this quote of Neil Gaiman that you start with in your lovely book. And then I was hoping you could start with a story of your own as well. So the quote is, "We all, adults and children, have an obligation to daydream. We have an obligation to imagine. It is easy to pretend that nobody can change anything, that we're in a world in which society is huge and the individual is less than nothing, an atom in a wall, a grain of rice in a rice field. But the truth is, individuals change their world over and over. Individuals make the future and then do it by imagining things can be different."
Beautiful. I was so touched by that when I first read that. It just arrived in my life at the perfect time. You know, there's a thing about writing a book about imagination. I had this idea of doing it, and I spent the first 3 or 4 months just talking to all the different people whose opinions I respected, saying, "Does anybody... I'm thinking of writing this book about imagination. Please tell me, really honestly, is that a ridiculous idea? Is anyone going to read a book about imagination?" And they all said, no, it's a really good idea, do it. And I think the thing for me with the story, because then, like you say, the book then goes into a sort of a 6-page kind of immersion in, like, if you woke up in 2030, and really trying to make the point that it's not a 2030 that's a utopia. It's not a 2030 that's a dystopia. It's the 2030 that resulted from us doing everything we could possibly have done between now and then. So we lived through a kind of a revolution of the imagination. You know, I meet so many people who are activists trying to do amazing things. And I'm myself included in this, and some of the work I'm doing in my town. And you just meet all the time people who say, "Oh, it's just a pipe dream. You're just a dreamer. It's never going to happen." And it's like, yeah, but it could. Why not open up that chink of possibility? And so there's one of the things that I love is Rupert Reed coined a term, which since when Manda Scott, who does the amazing Accidental Gods podcast, who has the most beautiful voice for radio, she has like a sort of like Gloria Hunniford times 10, where they talk about this idea of throughtopian storytelling, where they say, actually, what we need now isn't these great, amazing utopian visions of the world of 2270, where we're all living in this amazing sort of Shangri-La kind of. So you know, I was thinking, we have so many movies about everything going to hell in a handcart, and we have no stories really about things being turned around and people encountering the challenge like the climate emergency and managing to turn it around. And what did they do? And who did they meet? And how did that then spark other things? And how did it start to cascade? And how did their story become infectious? And how, ultimately, did what they did create longing in the people around them for something different than what was in front of them at that time? And, you know, there's very few examples of that kind of through utopian storytelling. But one of the things that I do in workshops, when I'm working with groups who are trying to make change happen or trying to be the change makers within their organizations who are trying to bring that imagination and accelerate things, is to say, imagine that in 2030, there was a book that was published, a novel, a story, the story of how the change that happened in this place happened, how it started with the people who were here, how it built, how it accelerated, who came on board, and that story is published as a story, and everybody wants to read it. It's the most exciting, thrilling story of ordinary people coming together and against all odds, creating something extraordinary. Write the copy that goes on the back of the cover of that book. This is a story of dot, dot, dot.
Okay, let's...
That's so beautiful.
Shall we do it? Shall I jump in?
Jump in.
This is the story of a deep remembering what shaped us as humans. I know you refer to this in the book, a bone memory. And this is a story where you might expect deep trials and tribulations, which of course occurred, but also it was a journey of deep joy, the joy of connecting back to the interrelatedness of everything, to listening to the song of a bird in the morning and putting that as the most important thing to do on a Monday, to get together and put our hands back into the earth and realize that is what shaped us, along with the stories, along with the singing, along with the gratitude for each other and for the planet. And this is the story how from disaster we remembered just in time that the impossible is possible.
Beautiful. Yeah. I mean, I would add that I think that just in time thing is really important. I think part of that as well was that people realized that there was no cavalry. They had assumed for a long time that the people in charge knew what they were doing. And certainly some elements of what happened during that time did come from government, because actually, when after those incredibly hot summers of 2023 and 2024, you know, when the Marshall Plan for climate change was brought in, that brought in the funding that was needed to do the kind of deep economic transition and move resources away from oil and gas, and by which time oil and gas companies had become complete social and economic pariahs. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with them at all. And the kind of new world of energy was expanding so quickly. I think the big shift that happened was that people realized that there was a very different model of economics that could happen. So things like donut economics, things like community-led development. You know, in 2024, there was the big crash of the banking sector that happened again, where the most sort of speculative, gambling, awful banking institutions collapsed under the weight of their own greed and psychopathy, whatever the word is. And this time, rather than bailing them out, we bought them into national ownership and harnessed their assets to drive the community, this new economy. And so one of the big things that you really notice in that like 2030 kind of time is that a lot more things are in the ownership models have changed. A lot more things are in community ownership, businesses, buildings, land. And I think one of the things that we really saw was that kind of excessive wealth that we saw in the early 2020s, you know, the people like Michelle Moon and people who just make millions of pounds out of doing nothing during COVID, apart from the fact that they just knew the right people. And that kind of Jeff Bezos kind of insane, Elon Musk levels of insane wealth, again, just became completely socially unacceptable and kind of repellent. And so actually people who had access to a lot of wealth really rolled up their sleeves, and I had to reimagine what it meant to be people of wealth and to be playing a very active role in the climate emergency. So there was a much wider sense that this needed everybody. You know, I do quite a lot of this because nowadays when I do my presentations, I was really inspired by this amazing T-shirt I saw this young woman wearing on the Black Lives Matter protest in Washington in 2020. It said, "I've been to the future, we won." Goosebumps. I thought it was so beautiful. I thought, wow, what would our activism look like if that was how we talked about this stuff? So now when I do talks, I tell everybody that in my town, we have successfully built a time machine. We have a very secret time travel research program. We've built the first fully functioning time machine that myself and a colleague travel regularly to that 2030. And we walk, you know, and we go there. So I always present it like, think of me as being the kind of Marco Polo of the climate movement. You know, I've been to 2030 and I'm going to tell you all about it. And one of the things that I always say to people is that one of the things that we have that we have realized by 2030 is that beavers are much better hydrological engineers than human beings could ever, ever be. And so all of the kind of uplands and all of the areas that when we were in the early 2020s, we'd see terrible flooding in lots of places, all of the places up river from there, we've basically just handed over to beavers and allowed them to completely rewild those places. And now they store huge amounts of water. We don't get those surges of water. So so we've learned a lot of kind of humility around nature that we're not the experts here. There are other species who understand this stuff much better.
And I think, again, coming back to just the indigenous knowledge in that, from lots of things, Braiding Sweetgrass is a book I love dearly, and Robin Wall Kimmerer talks a lot about the belief that the humans are the little brothers or little sisters, and actually all the beings around us have got the wisdom, and I, you know, got other wisdom because they've been here longer, and I like that human aspect as well. So let's say we go into 2030, and you just share a little, well, I'd invite you to share a little story of what that looks like in your town. Like what does it look like regarding the schools, regarding the local economies? And then after that story, yeah, well, let's start there.
Schools, well, there's a beautiful, actually, last time we were in 2030, we went to visit this amazing school that had been redesigned, that had been designed by the students. So students are now involved in designing. Schools are much more democratic and participative. So when they build new schools, the students design the schools. And we went to visit one that the center of the school was a rainforest, because that was what the kids decided they wanted. That's what they decided the center of their school should be. I think the model that really underpinned a lot of the shifts in education was that had been developed in Reggio Emilia in Italy in the 1940s, which was this idea that you support children to basically discover who they could be. And you do it by not teaching in subjects, but it's by teaching in projects. And every school at its heart has a workshop where you can go at any time and you can make whatever it is that you want to make. And that model has inspired people now all over the world. And they have a whole philosophy about how you design the space and how you design what people do. Also, schools are much more democratic. So, you know, two of my kids went to a school where the kids had the power to hire teachers, fire teachers, change the school rules. And you'd think, oh my God, this is going to be like Lord of the Flies. It's going to be horrendous. Actually, they have to learn how to do it first. They learn that with that kind of power comes responsibility, and they have to learn how to do it. And so democracy becomes a kind of a lived practice that they do regularly in the school. And as adults now, they're incredible in terms of how they are able to negotiate things and how they're able to set out proposals and set out their plans of what they want to do. It's quite amazing. So one of the things that happened was that the education system declared a climate emergency. at all levels at universities as well. So all university degrees are now taught through the lens of the climate and ecological emergency. So you leave ready to roll your sleeves up and get stuck into what's happening. And it's meant that university campuses have now become among the best kind of showcases of what that would actually mean in practice. So they now produce more energy than they use. You'll very rarely find lawn anymore on a university campus because they've all been turned into food gardens and the students learn how to grow food. Every time the university needs a new building, they build it using local ecological materials, and all the courses are involved in the construction of those buildings. And they're much more tied into their local economy. You know, there was there's this idea now that the primary function of the local economy of every town and every city is to ensure that money circulates as much as it can in that system before it leaves. And also every place now uses donut economics. So it has a clear sense of, well, we can't do too much of that because that eats and that pushes us into overshoot in terms of our relationship with the earth. And we can't push that way because we're part of a social economy and people need to be able to flourish. So that sweet spot that it identifies has really allowed a level of innovation that was just unthinkable in the kind of old kind of growth-based sort of economy. And every city now has a food belt around it. It's surrounded by a whole new economy of food and how food is produced. I love it. It's amazing. The beer is so much better. The food is so much better. There's all kind of amazing innovation for food around, like all the underground car parks that we had back in the mid-2020s that we don't need anymore. All of the underground car parks that we don't need anymore have now been repurposed for growing mushrooms. And there's also been the most incredible seaweed revolution all around the coast. Coastal communities who were at risk of really being ruined by the demise of fishing have replaced that with becoming the guardians of the recreation of the kelp forests all around the coast and of farming and harvesting all kinds of different culinary, delicious seaweeds. And so seaweed is much more now part of our diet, which is much better for our health, much better for the climate. The way I like to think about it is we had the idea back in the early 2020s that the only thing for us to do was to reduce and reduce and reduce our impact because our impact was always a negative one. But by then we had realized that if we did things in a very different way, actually, our impact could be a good one. The more seaweed we consumed, the more seaweed they had to plant, the more diverse the oceans became, more carbon got locked up in kelp forests because you can lock up carbon much, much quicker with seaweed than you can by planting trees. So all of these things, we started to move into more of a win-win-win-win way of doing things.
And that was a bleak moment, right? 2024, when we stopped talking about sustainability and we moved to thrivability, that all the projects were actually about how can we, as our responsible role as humans, the caretakers in a way, how can we actually help other beings, other ecosystems thrive? And it's not just about the sustainable aspect, but what if we leave the world a much better place, a much more thriving, joyful place than when we arrived on it?
Yeah, I think as part of the shift was as well that our government became fixated on this idea of net zero by 2050. It was this, you know, but actually net zero by 2050 was always a political target. It was never a scientific target. And actually what the scientists were saying was genuine zero by 2030, you know, much, much more ambitious to be anywhere consistent with the science. And what we realized was that the imagination loves limits. The human imagination flourishes with limits. It's like, you know, if I were to say to you, Lou, tell me a story. That's really difficult, right? Yeah. Top of the head. If I said, tell me a story about the mouse that lives behind you in down in the wood there behind you and has a little tiny piano and a hat, a pink hat with a picture of his girlfriend stuck on it, then I've put limits around it and you're like, oh, yeah. And the
he's locked it.
You're off.
He's wild, that guy. I can tell you that.
Yeah, I mean, so it's like when you study improv, they'll be like, right, you are a bus driver. You've had a terrible day. You're really grumpy. You just want to get home. And you are trying to get onto the bus carrying an enormous cello. Go. And then you've got that scenario and you've got the limits. And then that's what you do. And I've seen it again and again in workshops when people are doing donut economics, that it creates that sweet spot and says, right, figure that out. What are you going to do? You can't do that. like in the national example, you can't open new coal mines, you can't expand airports, you can't build new roads, you can't license any new oil and gas fields, and yet this nation needs to be able to flourish and people live better lives. That's where the really imaginative...
I really agree with that. Because there is like a grim reality that is... Yeah, well, in my experience, I've stopped reading the corporate media, both for many reasons. One, that I think it's just owned by other interests now, multinationals, etc. But just the nihilistic kind of quality of despair that it brings in. Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. The thriving aspect, the communal aspect that we're all longing for, right? We're all longing to know our neighbors. We're all longing to sit back on the lawn every night, to know our neighbors' kids, for our kids to grow up in a thriving environment where they know the young and the old.
Yeah, and many people, there was a survey done recently that said that 84% or something of people who work in North Sea oil and gas said they would much rather work in renewable. Like, you know, people do not work in and support the current system because they love it. They support it because it pays the mortgage and it means that they can do what they want to do. So if we can build something better, but, you know, when we said the thing with net zero, I was speaking at a conference recently of business people around net zero. And I said, one of the things we talk about net zero is it's a shit story. I said, you know, if the fifth Harry Potter book was called Harry Potter and the Race for Net Zero, it really would not have sold very many copies because it's not really, it's like, what's the story? Whereas actually, if we're talking about a kind of a well-being economy, a flourishing future, you know, it's a thing that I always try and do when I do talks where I speak from 2030, is it's, we have to cultivate longing. And longing is such a powerful word that we have in English. In lots of languages, there's no real equivalent for longing. I notice when I go to France or Italy or Germany and it's being translated, they're basically going, it's like desire, but like really, really, really strong desire. You know, but actually in the English language, the word longing is a kind of a deeper, more aching kind of yearning thing than really, 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 really strong desire, you know. And there's that lovely quote by Antoine Saint-Exupéry, who wrote The Little Prince, which says something like, you know, if you want to build a ship, don't ask people to gather wood and teach them how to build. What you need to do is to teach them to long for the endless immensity of the sea.
I have that quote right now. It'll be good. That I intended to read in that chat.
I read it out because you've got the actual quote.
That's hilarious. Well, I mean, love the synchronicity. Build a ship, don't drum up people to collect wood and don't assign them tasks and work, but rather teach them to long for the immensity of the sea.
Beautiful. It's beautiful. It's so beautiful. Recently, I was up at the big one, the Extinction Rebellion, big one up in London, and I did this talk just kind of in the street. It was really nice, surrounded by people, and I did it in my dressed in my time traveler's costume with my space helmet, and I did it like as if I've just got back from 2030. I tell you all about it. My god, it was fantastic. Just you wait, I'm gonna, oh my god, the bicycle rush hours in the morning were just like, blew my mind completely. And what, you know, in 2030, when they build new buildings, they build them using local materials, wood and straw and clay, because we don't use concrete anymore, because concrete caused 9% of climate change back in 2030, and all this kind of thing. And it's from very early on, being involved in the transition movement, was a thing that I really noticed, because I was used to start my talk with 20 minutes of why we need to do this stuff. All those graphs that go and pictures of tar sands and all that shit. And I noticed when I did that, it was really interesting, when you watch people kind of lean away. And as soon as you start to tell stories, you draw people in. You know, I went to this place. And you know, in this place, they're doing this. And these are the people. And they met here. And then they started this. And then it led to this. And people are kind of drawn into the stories. People love the stories. Because that's who we are. We're a storytelling creature. It's what makes us different from everything else. And it's the things that I just do more and more now. Just a couple of projects that I'm doing, that I've been doing since the book came out, is I'm working on this lovely project with an amazing, which is called Field Recordings from the Future. The idea is, if you had a time machine and you could travel to 2030 and you could record what it sounded like, could bring those recordings back to 2023 and put the headphones on someone and say, check this out. This is an actual recording of what London sounds like in 2030 with no cars. You'll hear public transport, children playing in the street, bicycles. This is what it sounds like. You know, it's like that. That could just be the thing that creates that longing that people are like, yeah, that's what I want the future to sound like. So I go to visit places that already sound like the future needs to sound like. And then I make recordings, and then I work with this amazing young electronic ambient music artist who then turns them into pieces of music. And my brief to him is that they should cultivate a nostalgia for the future. And it's such a, we've done 6 tracks so far. It's such a lovely project.
Then what are the stories that really are some of your favorites from 2023 or from the last few years that really kicked off this movement that we've now seen in 2030? What are some of those really powerful things that really touched your heart and made you realize, wow, this is possible?
Well, I think one of the things was that we became much better putting longing at the heart of our activism. So the poet Rilke once said, the future must enter into you a long time before it happens. That's probably on your list as well, is it? Yeah, he said, the future must enter into you a long time before it happens. And I always think, well, how different would our activism be if that was how we did it? That was what we were aiming to achieve, was to bring the future into people's lives. So I loved some of the things I've loved in 2023. There was the amazing emergence of what was called imagination activism. A young woman called Phoebe Tickell, who designed something called imagination activist training, which she ran with Camden Council, and which just spread and spread and spread. That idea that every organization is just going to carry on doing what it always did, unless it intentionally creates the space for a deep reflective process on how it might change direction. And unless it trains people within that organization to be the imagination activists who are saying, what if? No, we don't have to do it like that. Why do you think we have to do it like that? So there was a big explosion in imagination activism and training. A lot more activists started creating what I call pop-up tomorrows. So they started to take their dream of how they want the future to be and to actually make it a physical reality that people could see and touch and feel. And the first example that I remember was in 2019 when Extinction Rebellion closed Waterloo Bridge for 2 weeks and turned it into a forest with trees all down the middle. And people would stop and go, why can't it always be like this? I've met lots of people who were working near there and who stopped on that bridge and have since stopped their job and now work in the kind of climate social kind of space. You could see that the thing was that, so William Gibson, a science fiction writer, he once said, the future's already here. It's just not evenly distributed. So in 2023, everything we needed to do was already there. We weren't waiting for someone to create some amazing app or some silver bullet, amazing piece of technology that would save the day. We knew everything that we needed to do, not just to get our emissions down very, very quickly, but also to allow us to start at scale and at speed drawing down a lot of the emissions that were already in the atmosphere. So we started to shorten the scales on which our food system ran. We were inspired by the work that was happening in Liège in Belgium, the food belt model in Liège, which already by 2023 had spread to 6 other cities in Belgium and into other places, became the new normal very, very quickly. It meant that companies like Sodexo went out of business in about 2026. We saw a huge explosion in community-owned renewable energy and a huge withdrawal of kind of cultural, social legitimacy for oil and gas companies. We saw, you know, you could see in the community energy movement in cities like Bristol and Bath that spread very, very quickly. Cities looked to places like Utrecht and the Dutch government's philosophy, or not philosophy, the Dutch government's understanding that for every €1 million they invested in building good, safe, integrated cycling infrastructure, they actually saved €38 million off the national health bill. So we started to think differently. It's like, well, we know that it costs £11,000 to house a homeless person for a year, and it costs us £90,000 when that person is on the street in terms of mental health support and crime and drugs and all the different things that are then needed. So we shifted our economic thinking to say, actually, we need to be moving away from that idea of like austerity and not spending any money to we're investing in well-being and in a society that people can flourish in, and where we're all as well off as the poorest person in that society. So, yeah, the thing is, when you look back from 2013 to 2023, everything was already there. What we needed was, it's like when people say, well, what would your ideal transition city look like? I'd say, has the food system of Liège, has the cycling infrastructure of Utrecht, has the car-free neighborhoods of Freiburg, has the urban reforesting program of Barcelona, has the commitment to shutting its streets that you see to cars that you see in lots of other places. It has the community renewable energy of Bristol and Bath. You know, it's like all that stuff is already there. I think the thing that was really changed was that those stories just were everywhere, you know, because we realized in 2023 that the movements of activism couldn't do this without storytellers and poets and filmmakers and script writers and street artists and cartoonists and all those people who bring all of that. Artists can create longing. Scientists can't create longing. People who write reports can't create longing. Novelists can. Painters can. And we need that. And we needed that. And those things all came together in 2023. I'll tell you one little story, which I just love, and which I think actually there was a Hollywood movie made about this in 2024 that just became a massive, massive story. Was that so in Marseille in the south of France, which if anyone who's listening to this has been to Marseille, you may have been to Marseille, but you probably didn't go to the north of Marseille. So the north of Marseille is a very difficult part of the city. It has lots of poverty, lots of crime, drugs, lots of gangs, and lots of undocumented migrants, and very, very little jobs. Very few businesses will go and open in the north of Marseille. So in 2014, the French government subsidized McDonald's to open a McDonald's restaurant in the north of Marseille. And for 5 years, the McDonald's ran in the north of Marseille on a big roundabout next to a very busy road. And it employed about 72 people. And in 2019, the French government said to McDonald's, well, we funded you now for 5 years. I think you'll probably be all right now. And McDonald's said, well, we'll close it then. So McDonald's closed the restaurant in 2019, made everybody redundant just before COVID hit. So when COVID hit in that neighborhood, they said, in this neighborhood, you are much, much more at risk of dying from starvation than you were of dying from COVID, because all the work in the black economy dried up. There was no work for people. It was desperate. So there was one guy whose name I can't remember now, amazing, like a kind of gentle giant of a man who had been the manager of that place, who still had the keys. And so he reopened that restaurant as a food bank. And for a year and a half during COVID, they gave away 2,000 food parcels every week out of that McDonald's building. After a year and a half, the municipality in Marseille was so impressed that they bought them the building and they gifted it to this community organization. And they called themselves Après M, which means after M, like after McDonald's, you know, what comes after McDonald's. And they recently reopened it as what they call a fast social food restaurant. So they're reimagining it as a place where if you come in and you have no money, we'll feed you. If you have money, you can pay for it. And the whole philosophy is that they are a force for good, that they are sourcing food in a good way, and that they have this beautiful mindset of saying, okay, we're going to need a lot of salad. How could these neighborhoods produce the salad? So you start moving from seeing that banlieue, that kind of poor neighborhood, as being a kind of a ghetto, to being a market garden, to being a sort of a net exporter of salad. Why not? You know, and you're creating work for people. So that story, I think, of ordinary people in the most difficult of circumstances coming together, finding their voice and finding their feet, I think, again, was one that really, really inspired people. When that film came out in 2024, there was a spirit to that. I think it really touched people all over the world.
Yeah, I remember. I remember that film. That changed a lot.
We went to the premiere together. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
I do. I remember that it was a green carpet, and next to the green carpet, there was little salads from...
Never been to an event like it before.
No, but I also remember the movement that you had referred to in your book. I'm not sure when you wrote your book, from what it's taught.
Oh, long.
And long, that was a long time ago now.
Mists of time.
The future design that started in Japan, and I'm sorry to say I've forgotten the name of the person, and it was inspired by the Iroquois beliefs that every decision made took into account someone from the future. And so businesses, this started off in the democratic schools. That was one of the questions they asked the teachers. It started off in all the local communities, but also governments. There was this huge revolution that was inspired by the protests in France in May 1968. And it was a celebratory revelation, but one that said enough's enough with the co-opted governments that were kind of beholden to multinational corporations. And so again, this brought forth not one party, but different local elected people from different backgrounds, different genders, different ethnicities, socioeconomic backgrounds. The government wasn't something separate from community. And as you spoke about in your book, that old classic down.
84th reprint.
The movements, I think, in Mexico, you have to jog my memory, that started with imagination aspects in government, that was a very big thing in Mexico. And that popped up everywhere around the world.
Yeah. It's like the Ministry of Imagination, yeah, mayor of Mexico created. Yeah. I mean, it kind of became unstoppable. Like it was like there was, the more that you make that space for people to imagine, the more they want to do it. And then it started to create this sort of virtuous thing where people could say, oh, look, we imagined that and now it's happened. Look, it's over there. Well, what else could we do? You know, so this kind of belief built, you know. So actually one of the things, you know, I mentioned that myself and this guy called Mr. Kit, who is the guy I'm doing this field recordings from the future project with, you know, we often travel in our time machine to 2030 to gather these recordings. And when we go, we have to wear our kind of protective time traveler's costume, you know, which is not to protect us, it's to protect people when we get there. Because, you know, it's not to protect us. It's basically because what you find in that 2030, when you get that distance away from that kind of despair and the hopelessness and grief that was so present in our movements in 2023, what you notice when you step out into that birdsong filled kind of cleaner air of 2030 is that there's a belief. It's a fragile sense of belief, but there is a sense of, do you know what? I think we might just do this. Like people can see things changing around them. They can sense that there is a momentum. They can see the benefits, you know, where everything that we need to do for climate change will make the lives of 90% of people infinitely better. You don't see homelessness anymore. You don't see fuel poverty or food poverty anymore. People's lives have hugely improved as a result of those changes. And so it means that one of the rules that we have to follow as time travelers is that when we get there, we don't do any what we call past splaining. That we don't get there and say, yeah, that's never going to work. Because actually by then there is this sense of, do you know what? I think we might just do this. And so our role really is just to observe that and to capture that and to record that, to share it and bring back, rather than try and sort of convince them that they're not doing it right.
Mm. Yeah, and I remember in 2030, there's a big mural of something Joanna Macy said, where she compared, I think, I'll say 300,000 years, but I'm not sure if that's exact, but let's say she put human kind of culture at 300,000 years, and she compared it to a 24-hour time period. And so the first, from until 6 o'clock, we were living very much in connection to nature. But at 6 o'clock, 6 p.m. in the afternoon, the agricultural revolution started. So, yeah, I remember this big mural from Joanna Macy that was in lots of different places around the world. And it was referring to 300,000 years of human existence. And until 6 p.m. in the afternoon of this 24-hour clock, sorry, it compared 300,000 years in a 24-hour clock. Until 6 p.m. in the afternoon, we were very much living in gratitude and harmony with nature, telling stories by the fire, very much in the artistic, imaginative way of being, making our own instruments, our own devices. And then at 6 o'clock, the agricultural revolution started. At around 11:35, the industrial revolution started. And in the last 20 seconds, it was what was called the Great Forgetting, and that was the technological revolution. And so in 2030, they show that this 20-second period of our existence was a deep forgetting, but it was a really, really deep forgetting of what had shaped us as humans. And it's still taught in 2030 just for, not for any shaming, but just for a little period of grieving that we really did forget. And what an exciting time to be in 2030 now that we're in the remembering. We're in the age of remembering.
Yeah, it's the most exhilarating time to be a teenager. You know, in the early 2020s, when there was that amazing Fridays for Future movement and all those young people who filled the streets in their millions and nothing really changed, and who were left quite sort of cynical and despondent. Actually, things started to move quite quickly with that. And actually, to be 18 in 2030 is to just be like almost have your mind blown with the possible options of what you can do going forward and what you can be part of. And, you know, that kind of indigenous wisdom and understanding is now part of how our education system works. Because, you know, in the early 2020s, we were still educating young people for the 20th century. It was ridiculous. So now we teach them to be guardians of the world and custodians, and yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, and we even reimagined language as we looked at some other languages. I think it's Potawatomi language has 70% verbs and 30% nouns, whereas in English it's 70% nouns, which really presents the world as a dead place. So we have this whole reimagining of language that we realized we wouldn't say to our grandmother, oh, it made a lovely dinner. And so we realized, and we returned to this totemic relationship of having this relationship with tree and with soil and with strawberry, where we would have time where we would sit out in nature regularly and connect to these different alive beings.
Mm-hmm.
So if you, now you have come back, you've taken off your time suit, glad to say you're clothed. If you could just have a short moment with someone in 2023 who feels really just hopeless and, yeah, has just given up the cause, really, what would you say to that person?
Firstly, I would say the fact that you feel like that is kind of a good sign, because it shows that you have a heart. You know, it's like the people who are experiencing eco-anxiety, sometimes it's presented like as if that's a problem. You know, eco-anxiety shows that you have a heart and that you're paying attention. It's the people who don't experience eco-anxiety are the ones we really need to worry about. You know, the people who experience eco-anxiety, you know, you can work with that because they have a heart and they care and they're aware of the pain and the suffering and the grief that is kind of rampant in the world at the moment. I would say that to experience grief and pain and loss at this time is entirely natural, but that if we get stuck in that, it can be kind of paralyzing. Like at the same time, if you're optimistic all the time, I think you're really not paying attention. And I think there's a sort of a going backwards and forwards between those two things. The thing is, if we get stuck in either of those things, I think it is natural. It's like a cycle. And for me, it's like alternating current. You know, it's like that's where the energy comes from. When you get good at being able to go into the grief and work with the grief and have the tools, the practices. I remember it's amazing. I went to speak at a conference in Paris called We Love Green, and I was on a stage. The woman who was on the stage with me was this incredible Native American elder. When Standing Rock was where all those protests against the Keystone XL pipeline were going on, it was the biggest coming together of different tribes that had ever been experienced. It was awesome. Facing this extraordinary brutality from private security firms hired by oil and gas companies, backed up by the police, but it was brutal private security firms pepper spraying people, setting dogs on people. It was horrendous. And I said to her, how do you manage, like, in your culture, in your tradition, when your young people have been out on the front line all day being assaulted basically by the state, and they come back at the end of the day with tear gas in their eyes and bite marks from dogs on their bodies, how do you manage that trauma before they go out again the next day? And she said, as soon as they come back, we go into ceremony. We go into circle and we go into ceremony and we stay there as long as we need to. And my friend Sophie Banks, who is incredible, who created this idea of inner transition, the transition movement we talked about, yes, there's the outer transition with solar panels, the whatever energy companies. There's the inner transition, which is like, how do we do this? How do we support each other to do this work? How do we minimize burnout and stuff? And she talks about that we need to design these ways to come back into balance again. And that what they were doing at Standing Rock was the most beautiful example of that I've ever heard. But when we're doing this work, we're being buffeted all the time between that kind of optimism and that pessimism. And we need those return paths that allow us to come back to balance. And it could be a meditation practice. It could be stuff we do together with other people. And she would argue that in our groups, in our movements, we need to design in those return paths so that in our meetings and how we work together, there's time for stillness and there's time for reflection and there's time for supporting each other. And that we start every meeting with a go round so that actually if somebody's father died the night before, we all know about that and we can accommodate that into how we work together because we meet as friends who care about each other rather than just as colleagues who have an agenda to work through. So I think that concept of return paths is really, really powerful in allowing us to find that balance between the kind of the inner and the outer. So if I was speaking to somebody, I would say that your imagination needs stories. And that if you just set up your social media feed, if you seek out media that are just going to barrage you with endless stories about how terrible everything is, you're going to end up feeling pretty terrible. But there is so much good stuff happening there. Everywhere I go, every town, every city, there's so many amazing things happening, community energy stuff, local food stuff. Follow those things. Follow Transition Together, which is the network for England and Wales, which is putting out all these great stories. Read Positive News Magazine. Follow We Are Possible, follow the different organizations who are putting those kind of stories out there and fill your kind of memory banks up with stories of it turning out okay. And I think, and you'll find that really, really helps.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm just realizing now the importance of gratitude and grief. I think you said it with the optimism and pessimism that we need to feel both in equal measure because they both, yeah, the gratitude is subversive in a way to the capitalist culture. And I remember when it really started to collapse, the gratitude was a big thing. But also, as you say, the grief, both show how much we care. Both show how much we care. And
they both have great gifts for us if we can learn how to work with them.
Thank you so much, Rob. I didn't expect us to go in this way, but I just felt like a childlike joy as we've been talking like that. So thank you. So I feel really grateful, and again, just emphasizing with your classic From What Is to What If, that really, really, as you say, helped me become aware of all the great that is going on right now. And those were the seeds that started to bloom. And those seeds then got the cross-pollination effect. But thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, my absolute pleasure. Thank you. I've really enjoyed this. And I mean, I think the other thing I would say about those seeds is that wherever you're living, if you look around you, there are the seeds, there are the young seedlings of that new world there in terms of the emerging local food economy, CSA projects, local currency projects, community energy cooperatives, so many things there. But they will only be able to become that future if you support them. Like, if you're happy to leave your money in the HSBC bank when actually you could be investing in community renewables in your town, you could be becoming a member of a local CSA, you could be investing in supporting a local project that's starting up and is looking for investment. If you look at that project in Liège, they raised 5 million euros of investment from the people of Liège, investing into those co-ops. That's why that project worked, because people saw a good idea and they heard a story, a great story that inspired their curiosity, and they thought, I want to see that happen. But people stepped up and they put their money into it and backed it. And I think that's a really important part of it. You know, if we're going to sort of sit back passively and go, wow, there's a local currency in my town, it's really cool, but I've never actually used it, it's not going to be there for very long. If there's a community energy project and you never support it, it's not going to be there very long. So there is a new world emerging around you, but it needs you to roll up your sleeves and get involved and support it and make it normal. Make it the new normal in the conversations that you
have. Nice. Beautiful. Beautiful. Thank you. Thanks for listening. If this episode moved you in any way and you'd like to share, or you'd like to request a guest that has really inspired you, then please contact me at moversandshakerspod@gmail.com. Thanks again. Take care.